Good morning. Good morning. And how's that level of sound? Is that good? Okay. I'll try and keep my voice there. I started out preaching in a place where we had no amplification system, and so I had to project, and then I was too loud when working with a microphone, and since then I've sort of drifted. So let me know if I'm too soft. I appreciate it. Greetings on the first day of October. When I was a kid, October was just, 30 days were just between me and Halloween. That's what this month was about. And so I thought I would do a Halloween theme sermon, even though it's only the first. So my first reading this morning is from the first chapter of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, whose credits tell us that she is, quote, the author of Sense and Sensibility, Persuasion, Mansfield Park, and other masterpieces of English literature. Who here has read it? That's a good showing, really good showing. Is that more women than men? Does that have some characterization as a woman's novel? I don't know. Here it is, first part. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. However little known the feeling or views of such a man may be on his first entering a neighborhood, this truth is so well fixed in the minds of the surrounding families that he is considered the rightful property of some one or other of their daughters. "My dear Mr. Bennet," said his lady to him one day, "have you heard that Netherfield Park is let at last?" Mr. Bennet replied that he had not. "But it is," returned she, "for Mrs. Long has just been here, and she told me all about it." Mr. Bennet made no answer. My second reading is from the first chapter of Jane Austen's more recent Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, adapted with the assistance of Seth Graham Smith, whose credits inform us that he, quote, once took a class in English literature. Who here has read that one? Okay. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a zombie in possession of brains must be in want of more brains. Never was this truth more plain than during the recent attacks at Netherfield Park, in which a household of 18 was slaughtered and consumed by a horde of the living dead. "My dear Mr. Bennet," said his lady to him one day, "have you heard that Netherfield Park is occupied again?" Mr. Bennet replied that he had not, and went about his business of dagger sharpening and musket polishing, for attacks by the unmentionables had grown alarmingly frequent in recent weeks. "But it is," returned she. Mr. Bennet made no answer. You gotta love that inimitable Jane Austen style, don't you? Deborah?
It's actually.
Oh, that's right. The
so
choir.
Now for a musical interlude by our YE's choir.
Should have known that.
No, it's all good. The choir meets every second and fourth Sunday. Everyone's welcome.
Good morning. My name's Linda Cho. While the choir is and the band is assembling here, I want to just do give you a little bit of background about the song we'll be singing. This background is gleaned from two authoritative sources, the Bible and Wikipedia. The Rivers of Babylon is based on the biblical Psalm of 137, verses 1 through 4, a hymn expressing the lamentations of the Jewish people in exile following the Babylonian conquest of Jerusalem in 586 BC. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. They carried us away in captivity, requiring of us a song. Now how shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? The song also has words from Psalm 19, verse 15. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight. The Jamaican setting of these words, which we will be doing, from the Bible, are based on the Rastafarian faith. Rastafari originated among impoverished and socially disenfranchised Afro-Jamaican communities in the 1930s. In the Rastafarian faith, The term Babylon is used for any governmental system which is either oppressive or unjust. By the rivers of Babylon refers to living in a repressed society and the longing for freedom, just like the Israelites in captivity. The original of the version of the song specifically refers to Rastafarian belief in Haile Selassie, crowned the emperor of Ethiopia in 1930 and believed by many to fulfill a biblical prophecy. References to the Lord in the biblical text were changed to Farai and King Alpha. Both of these terms refer to the Ethiopian emperor. Brent Dow, the lead singer from the Melodians, who wrote this song, adapted Psalm 137 to the new reggae style because he wanted to increase the public's consciousness of the growing Rastafarian movement and its calls for black liberation and social justice. Rivers of Babylon.
I could have forgotten that the choir was going to sing. We talked about it and prepared for it and talked a bit about how that Bible, which can be an instrument of oppression in so many hands, can also be a liberation, instrument of liberation in other hands, right? Right. Same tool. Interesting how that works. Well, we started bringing our son Saad to the Shakespeare Festival in Ashland when he was very young. It didn't take much of Othello and Macbeth with their battles and swordplay to convince him that Shakespeare was pretty cool. He liked King Lear and his fool and donkey-eared Nick Bottom in A Midsummer Night's Dream. He got how Shakespeare used references to Greco-Roman gods like Jove or Apollo to avoid running foul of the church or the crown. As for the non-Shakespeare plays that also run at the festival, he enjoyed several staged versions of the old Marx Brothers films, especially after we named our new dog Zeppo. Zeppo played straight man to his brothers Groucho, Chico, and Harpo. He balked a little, though, when we got tickets for The Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde. He'd somehow gotten the idea that this was indoor, nice clothes, tea-sipping entertainment. But he carefully avoided saying anything about chick lit or chick theater, even if he was thinking it. Knowing that he'd end up enjoying himself and that his mom and I weren't taking no for an answer, I started to tease and cajole about how he'd liked every other play we'd picked. Besides, I continued, with an evil gleam in my eyes, halfway through the first act is when the demon sword comes out. Someone would leap out and slice the legs off the tea table with his gruesome weapon, and then the mayhem would get really serious. He knew I was kidding, or was at least pretty sure. When the play was underway, I leaned over and I said, "The sword is coming any second now." All his mom looked daggers at me. For his birthday, I searched the fantasy section of our local used bookstore until I found two with lurid covers. One was actually called Demon Sword, which actually stars a hero named Long Dirk. No kidding. The other was Sword of the Demon. Real boy books. Bloody stuff, but still fluff, unlike Oscar Wilde, who could be lighthearted without being lightweight. You get the connection, I'm sure, between that dad and lad Demon Sword riff and Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, or its spin-off, Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters, Jane Slayer, and Android Karenina. They all play with the idea that adding gory fun to a classic story will get us past labels like chick lit or geezer lit, depending on your prejudice or your pride. Which brings me to this morning's telling of, get ready, Judges 9 with zombies. That is the book of Judges, chapter 9 in the Bible. I need to go back a little bit to introduce its main characters. Gideon was the hero of a great battle against raiders from the east. The Israelites wanted to make him a king in a land where there had never been one before. But Gideon was humble and didn't want the job. He was too busy with his biblical marriage. Biblical meaning straight out of fantasy lit for boys, meaning he had many, many beautiful wives and 70 sons. But in spite of their father's pious refusal to be king, these boys did inherit some governing authority when he died. He also had one other son by a concubine, a boy who called himself Abimelech. Graced with more attitude than any real ability, he grows up in his brother's shadow, filled with rage and resentment. His very name indicates his fantasy sense of entitlement. Abimelech means, "My father is king," even though this land has never had one and really never should. At one point, he goes to his mother's kinfolk for sympathy and money and asks, "Which is better for you? That all the sons of Gideon, who are 70 persons, rule over you, or that one rule over you? Remember also that I am bone of your bone and flesh of your flesh. Only I can help you. One guy, a guy who looks like you." They buy it, and he uses their money to hire, quote, "idle and reckless men" as followers. And then he came to his father's house and butchered his 70 brothers on a single stone, all but Jotham, the youngest, who had hidden himself. Then all the citizens came together and made Abimelech king. I trust that all of this sounds sufficiently Bible-y so far. But now comes something that you might not have expected, and no, it's still not time for the Walking Dead to enter the picture. It's time instead for talking trees. Walking and talking trees. The Bible borrows from an older layer of oral literature and stories too ancient and widespread to be the sole possession of any one religion. Muslims speak about a universal source for all scriptures that they call the Mother of Books. Or you could call it the Under-Bible. Now it rises to the surface as Jotham, the only survivor of the massacre, goes to a hilltop and shouts, "Listen to me, you citizens, and may God listen to you. Once upon a time, The trees came to anoint a king, and they said to the olive tree, be king over us. But the olive tree answered, what? Leave my rich oil by which gods and men are honored to come and hold sway over the trees? So the tree said to the fig tree, then will you come be king over us? But the fig tree answered, what? Leave my good fruit and all its sweetness to come and hold sway over the trees? So the trees said to the vine, will you come and be king over us? But the vine answered, what? Leave my new wine, which gladdens gods and men, to come and hold sway over the trees? You hear, and I'm sure you noticed, how the radically monotheistic Bible uses that gods and men riff, just like Shakespeare uses the names of Greek and Roman gods to set his action in safely ancient once upon a times, so he couldn't be accused of using his work to comment on contemporary socio-political situations. In their own tricky political times, the Bible writers also needed to maintain a screen of deniability while feeling powerless under a despotic ruler. So it continues. Then all the trees said to the thorn bush, will you then be king over us? And the thorn said to the trees, if you really mean to anoint me as your king, then come under the protection of my shadow. If not, fire shall come out of the thorn and burn you all. Nothing here about ever having gladdened gods or people or having served anyone. Just fire, just threat. Then Jotham said, now have you acted fairly and honestly in making Abimelech king? You've risen with him and butchered my brothers on a single stone block. If you think you've acted fairly, I wish you joy in Abimelech and wish him joy in you. If not, may fire come out of Abimelech and burn you, and may fire come out of you to burn Abimelech. As the youngest son, Jotham himself was probably never one of the serious contenders to become ruler, but he grieves for his brothers who were. Now he makes his escape, leaving the citizens to ponder whether, like the trees, they know what choices they will come to celebrate and which they will live to regret. Within 3 years, many citizens find that they do regret their choice to live under the shadow of the gloomy Abimelech, city folk especially. At a drinking party in one city, people begin to speak publicly against their king, and the king hears word of it. He can't stand any criticism and will obsess all night over the slightest slight. He attacks the city and kills the protesters, then pulls the city down and sows its site with salt. After learning that a number of survivors have taken refuge, have taken sanctuary in a temple, Abimelech cut brushwood and took it and hoisted it on his shoulder. He said to his men, you see what I'm doing? Be quick, and do the same. So each man cut brushwood, then they followed Abimelech and laid the brushwood against the hall and burned it over their heads. Thus all the occupants died, about 1,000 men and women. And children too, I'm sure, unless you imagine that they were at school or in daycare. So far, we're still in the actual text of the Bible. The Bible can be very appropriate for the month of October and Halloween. I haven't added any zombies yet, though some of Abimelech's followers are behaving like that Caribbean sort of voodoo zombie, those impressionable people who've been starved and hurt and poisoned into a weakened state and now move in a sort of trance to do their master's bidding. It's a reversible condition, yes, but for now they obey. You see what I'm doing. Be quick and do the same. Repetitiveness and imitation are the key here. See what I do? Now you do it too. Don't think, just do it. Fast, fast. This king is nothing if not a good hustler, folks. So the next scene in the story is like a replay of the last one. Abimelech and his men then went to another rebellious city. He really hates those cities, just like they hate him. Besieged it and took it. There was a strong tower in the middle of the city, and all the citizens, men and women and children, took refuge there. They shut themselves in it and went to the roof. Abimelech came to the tower and attacked it. As he approached the entrance to set fire to it, a woman, threw a millstone down on his head and cracked his skull. Now listen carefully to this next part. It's still from the Regulation Bible. He called hurriedly to his young armor bearer and said, "Draw your sword and dispatch me, or men will say of me, 'A woman killed him.'" So the young man ran him through, and he died. Thank you for waiting so patiently for the zombies. It's time now, finally. So let's imagine that while killing his brothers on that bloody rock, Abimelech was infected with the zombie virus. No one knows it yet. Now we come to his encounter with that woman who stands so far above him in every way imaginable. While Abimelech has been doing his rotten business with towers and palaces and egging on goons to attack people, she has been serving her community for decades and decades, working that heavy millstone to meet the needs of women and children and the poor. And now she drops it on his head. Then his young follower runs him through to spare him the shame of being defeated by a woman, as he was so soundly. But a few days later, somehow, he's back. He repeats the same nonsense, tries to start his fire with the same kind of wood, and again, the woman takes him down. She's not Wonder Woman or half divine, just fully human and almost too familiar. People have all known her for years. There's no need to even say her name. But she's smart. She's skilled, and her aim is true. Down he goes, out comes the sword again, the end. But no, he comes back another time. Same guy, same shtick, same pile of flimsy, fast-burning sticks heaped against the wall. She dispatches him a third time, which really should be the charm, to put a stop to this creep and the harm that he's doing. But here he comes again. And now he's not alone. He still has voodoo-style follower zombies, and now they're joined by the walking dead kind we all know much better. There are 70 of them. Who are they? His brothers. All those other candidates to be ruler, whom he had taunted and humiliated before slaughtering them on that rock. They all had a better claim to power. They'd honed their skills, worked their way up, but now it seems they've forgotten who they are. Tattered, vacant, lost. They're his to command, at least for now. At least for now. The assault on the city intensifies. The woman can do no more for now. We'll have to wait for another leader to shoulder the millstone and take up her strategic position. So that's Judges 9 with zombies. A real cliffhanger. What's going to happen next? According to Jotham, it's up to the trees. If you think you've acted fairly, I wish you joy in Abimelech and wish him joy in you. If not, may fire come out of Abimelech and burn you, and may fire come out of you to burn Abimelech. Will Abimelech burn his supporters, like Jotham has predicted? Or will they turn and burn him? Will they wake up and recognize how much they need and how much they have in common with the city and all its sophisticated, educated people, its many immigrants, its rich tapestry of queer and interesting and creative folk? Will the young man who now stands on Abimelech's side get tired of the same thing happening over and over again, till at last he swings high instead of stabbing low, swings high and removes this swollen head of state who thinks he's king of a land that's not a kingdom? I hope so. Somebody from that side has got to find the courage to act on the people's behalf. Maybe some have started to think about cutting this nasty orange tiger back down to a sad little mouse. Sad. So will the others he's misled gain control of their brains, regain their brains? Don't forget those folks who've been starved and hurt and poisoned into a weakened state. Abimelech has appealed to their wounded pride and their prejudices so effectively. Only I can do it with my flesh like your flesh, my bone like your bone, and look, the same skin tone. He's piled up misinformation and disinformation, heaps of lightweight brushwood, so much empty garbage against our walls, against the structures of civil society. The structures of civil society. And he's fanned it into a blaze that threatens what we treasure most. If we're going to save it, folks on both sides of the city wall of the urban-rural divide will have to work together and to understand why they must before this land that's not a kingdom is burned beyond recognition. I warn you, if anyone accuses me of using today's worship service to comment on current affairs, grind my own axe or my own demon sword, I will deny it, just like Shakespeare or the Bible writers would have done in their time. I'm just trying to reawaken your interest in classic literature, religious or otherwise. If that interest has died in you, I hope it will rise again, not in the zombie way, not even in the Jesus way, but in a way that will bring new strength to all. The classics remind us we've seen this before in Macbeth, Mr. Darcy, Wonder Woman, and Abimelech too. They show us types and patterns that we can use to help us cope and prepare for our next actions. The treasures of our tradition are also powerful, powerful tools. More so than any millstone or any demon sword. May we learn to use them and use them well. So let me just add this. Don't swing low, aim high, and heavens, please don't miss. So may it be.